Coming today, and I am going to turn it over to Mr. Tom Wack, the president of the Judicial Learning Center Board.
Good afternoon. I see many distinguished members of the bench and bar here, and I have been specifically instructed not to introduce any of you because of time restrictions. So I hope I don't get in trouble for that. I want to introduce Lynn Jackson. Lynn is the president and founder of the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation. She is the great-great-granddaughter of Dred and Harriet Scott. She has a Bachelor of Science degree in Business Administration from the Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. She has worked in numerous positions in St. Louis, Business Operations Director of the Girl Scout Council of Greater St. Louis, the Black Women's Entrepreneurial Network, where she was president. She worked at the law firm where I hang out. In connection with Dred Scott Heritage Foundation, she has spoken many times. She participated in the Dred Scott Symposium at Washington University and hosted other Dred Scott descendants for the sesquicentennial of the decision in March of 2007. She has spoken at the Harvard Museum on the 150th anniversary of the decision. She was a panelist at the inaugural Underground Railroad Research Institute, and she is here today to tell us about the foundation and her family.
Good afternoon. Well, thank you for being here. It is indeed a pleasure to always be able to come out and represent for Dred and Harriet Scott. I want to thank the U.S. courts and Rachel in particular for calling me and inviting me to be here today. I have many opportunities to go out and speak, but it's always a pleasure to do something in St. Louis where our city is supporting this wonderful history that belongs to all of us. I would like to share with you a few things about our foundation. The Dred Scott Heritage Foundation was established in 2007, and the particular reason that I did this was because I did not want to sit at home and hear on the news on March 6th of 2007, well, today is the 150th anniversary of the Dred Scott decision and yada, yada, and then it would go on to the next thing. And if that was all that I would have had to do with it, that would have been a shame. So I felt like our family should participate, and I had no idea that it was going to continue and blossom and bloom as it has. But it's been quite a privilege to be a representative for our family and for the courage and tenacity, perseverance, and all those things that Dred and Harriet endured so that they could make a difference in the world. Now, I'm pretty sure most of you know their story, and I'm not here to do that today, but essentially I just want to give you a one-sentence thumbnail that this couple together, Harriet and Dred, separately and together, filed their own petitions for freedom at the old courthouse. And it took 11 years and 5 trials for them to get to the U.S. Supreme Court, where it was told to them that they were not citizens, therefore their case should not even be in court, and that they had no rights, and that even free blacks were, at that time now, not citizens. So this was huge, and it had a lot to do, a major catalyst to the Civil War. And at that point, we like to share with people the outcome of that was that they did get their freedom from the Blow family, who were their original owners, but also they were very pivotal in us getting our 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And so their story is a very special one, and we've been able to tell over the last 5 years a lot more about them personally. And so when we go out, we do that. The foundation has 3 primary objectives. That is commemoration, which is why we had the 150th. That continues today to where we are now looking at very soon, being able to erect a statue of Dred and Harriet outside the old courthouse. And when I say soon, I mean very soon. So I'm really happy about that and the support that we've had for it. Also, we found out that there was no bust of him in Jefferson City in the Hall of Famous Missourians. So over time, we've been able to work on that. We've been able to work on that, and I'm sure you've heard about it in the news. So we don't have a date yet for certain reasons. However, it will happen, and that's a good thing. So we'll be able to commemorate him there. And there are just so many other things that are happening right now. It's a good thing. I would like to share, as far as the courts go, that I recently was, in fact, it was in March, I was at the the Indiana Supreme Court, and their court and their Indiana Bar Foundation sponsored Mark Shurtleff, who is the Utah Attorney General, and myself, along with Greg Zoeller, their Attorney General. And we had sessions in their court for students, for adults, and at Martin University, and it was really wonderful. So even outside of St. Louis and outside of Missouri, people are celebrating the history and the story of Dred Scott. The other thing that happened recently, which was very wonderful, which bodes to our second objective, which is education, was the invitation to come to Arkansas, Little Rock, Arkansas, at Central High School. And that's where the Little Rock Nine made their stand to integrate the schools there. So within 24 hours, I gave four presentations there, two to high school student groups, one to the university, and another to the general public. And it's a phenomenal story down there. I mean, the museum that's attached to the high school is a National Parks Museum. And as you know, we work very closely with our national parks here. It was a wonderful experience. So just to give you a little taste of some of the things that are happening, and they are happening in rapid succession at this time. So I'm very grateful for that. Also, I just want to share one more thing, that Dred and Harriet Scott are what we call icons of civil rights. They are not the first, but they are among the pioneers of those who did what they could do, which was very sacrificial. When you hear our presentations, you will find out the degree to which they made the decision ongoing. So many times I'll hear people say, Dred Scott, yeah, I'm like, wait a minute, I know, I remember that from school. Wait a minute, isn't he that guy who? And it's like that everywhere you go. So our purpose is not to have that be the case any longer, but that we understand their significance in history. And as we go through the commemorative educational aspects, then we come to our third objective, which is reconciliation. And briefly, I'll just share that I understood the commemoration. I could do that in my sleep. Education is a no-brainer, but reconciliation, that's another story. So I wait for directions from upstairs to figure out how to do that. And so far, the directions have been to have a Dred and Harriet Scott Reconciliation Forum in Marshfield, Missouri, of all places. I can't go into why right here now. You're free to ask me that later. But it has been phenomenal. And we will be doing that again in 2 weeks in Marshfield, Missouri. And you're invited to come down and see the second annual Dred and Harriet Scott Reconciliation Forum. It consists of descendants of people whose ancestors have done something critical in history. And we've come together as the sons and daughters of reconciliation. So there are a lot of wonderful things happening. And I appreciate the support. I appreciate the interest. I'm very happy to see this room filled today. And I know that you're going to enjoy the presentations because I met Judge Benton at the 2007 Wash U Symposium. And he was somebody that was just burned into my heart and mind, a beautiful person, a beautiful spirit, a great soul, intelligent, and I'm sure I've never worked with him, but you know he's honest and he's a man of integrity. It oozes from him. So I'm very pleased to be on a program with him today. And then Bob Moore is my old buddy from the old courthouse. And everywhere I go, I always share these relationships because I'm thankful for what people have done. And Bob is a historian. That's his title. But I think he does a lot more than that. When I found out that was his title, I thought, but what's the rest of it? Because he has done so many things. He is, and all of his park rangers are just incredibly knowledgeable about St. Louis history. And if you have not been there, I would surely recommend that you go see the Dred Scott exhibit, the St. Louis exhibits, and the new movie. A lot of people don't know there's a theater over there, and the History Channel has done an 18-minute vignette on Dred Scott. and I'm privileged to be in it, actually, but it's really well done. So these two gentlemen are going to inspire you, I'm sure, and they're going to teach you, and that's for sure. And I'm just thankful to be here, and I want to say one more thing about Brian Cave, because Tom Wack worked there, and he still does. I worked there for 12 years as General Services Manager, and it was one of the best jobs I've ever had, and I've been blessed in my career. But Brian Cave has been an incredible support to me personally and to our family in terms of the commemorative anniversary. And they continue with pro bono services, as well as when the statue does come, their name will be front and center again. So I want to thank them and thank our panel. Thank you for being here, and enjoy the afternoon. Thank you.
The Honorable Dwayne Benton. Judge Benton is a graduate from Northwestern University. Obtained his BA there. Wait till you hear all the degrees he has. He obtained his JD from Yale Law School. He obtained an MBA later on from Memphis State and an LLM from the University of Virginia School of Law. I am told, although I have not confirmed it, that he is both a lawyer and a CPA. I know he's a lawyer. It's the CPA part that I'm unsure about. Judge Benton served as a captain in the U.S. Navy Naval Reserve from 1972 to 2002, as judge advocate in the U.S. Navy from 1975 to 1979. He has taught at the University of Missouri School of Law and Westminster College in Fulton. He served on the Supreme Court of Missouri from 1991 to 2004. And was Chief Justice there from 1997 to 1999. He was nominated to the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals in 2004, confirmed that year, and has served on the 8th Circuit ever since. Welcome, Judge Benton.
Thank you, Tom. I probably should stop right now after Ms. Jackson's introduction and Tom's introduction and not disappoint you further. But I guess since it's on your schedule, I should proceed. I would be remiss, though, if I didn't take a second and acknowledge that the Chief Judge of the Eighth Circuit, Bill Riley, is in the front row, along with District Judge Rod Sipple, and I noticed Judge Adelman. Are there other judges here? And I should ask, because I'll miss someone who's sitting in some place. Judge Grady's not here, is he? He had promised me a special biography on one of the judges involved, the trial judge in the circuit court, had promised me a special biography, and I've not received it yet. He must be looking for it. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Well, I've been blessed in many ways in my life, as you heard. But one way I was blessed is while I was on the Missouri Supreme Court, I began reading particularly about the Missouri Supreme Court case involving Dred Scott. And I did give you a diagram so you can follow all the bouncing cases. It's a little bit on the complex side, and I think the best way to explain it is to start at the top. The top is the United States Supreme Court case. Excuse me. And it is the one that you've heard so much about. You remember it from grade school, the one Ms. Jackson referred to. It is the case there given in 1857 by the United States Supreme Court. If you look down on the right, you see that U.S. Circuit Court. Now, that was not a court of appeals. I've got to say that because we also have some clerks here, and they got to get credit for this, so they need to learn this. Eighth Circuit clerks. There was no court of appeals till 1890. This was a trial court. It was set up in the Judiciary Act of 1789 as a trial court where cases were held. It was called a U.S. Circuit Court, United States Circuit Court. It was, of course, here in St. Louis. And Judge Sipple, Judge Adelman, the judge on that was the local district judge. Technically, the circuit judge here was a United States Supreme Court judge who was supposed to come here on circuit. There were no circuit judges then. There were district judges and Supreme Court judges. Judge Robert Wells was the judge who was the circuit judge who did this part of the Dred Scott case. He was the second district judge here, and by the way, the first district judge in the Western District of Missouri. We have some lay people here. There are two federal districts in Missouri, Eastern, St. Louis, and surrounds, and Kansas City and surrounds is the Western. But anyhow, Judge Wells, also the one, trivia question, who designed the Missouri State Seal when he was in the legislature. First judge of the Western District, second judge of the Eastern District. That's just to explain the chart to you quickly. The case at the top there is the United States Supreme Court case of 1857. I'm not going to talk much about it, but I do need to give you a feel for it so you understand where I'm coming from. Let me do that by giving you some quotations. That might be the best way to do it. Frederick Douglass, abolitionist in order, immediately said it was a lie before God. Chief Justice Hughes, who wrote a history of the Supreme Court, said it was a self-inflicted wound and a national calamity. Judge Robert Bork, in more recent times, has said it's the worst constitutional decision in American history. Other commentators have called it things like this: the worst atrocity in the Supreme Court's history, the most disastrous opinion ever written, the most odious action ever taken by any branch of the federal government, a ghastly error. I could continue, and but you all get the drift. And here's what the Supreme Court said in that case. The Supreme Court, Professor Cass Sunstein has said, a law professor has said, that instead of deciding the issue at hand, they decided every issue possible. And they began by saying that no Negro could ever be a citizen of the United States. By the way, I left out Chief Justice Wolf, who was on the same program with Ms. Jackson and I here. And pardon me, Mike, for doing that. You're so small, I missed you there. Mike and I served together 6 years in the Missouri Supreme Court. He's put up with me for years. But anyhow, back to Dred Scott. They said, first of all, that no Negro could be a citizen of the United States. And by the way, Chief Justice Taney wrote it, it looked like no free Negro, no any kind of Negro, could be a citizen of the United States. That was the first proposition. His second proposition was, if that wasn't enough, his second proposition was, holding was, that Congress had no power to exclude slavery from the federal territories. This is a quote. Quote, "The right of property in a slave is distinctly and expressly affirmed in the United States Constitution." And so, therefore, he had to go and declare the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional. The Missouri Compromise was an 1820 law that picked the bottom line of Missouri and said north of there, no slavery. South of there, there could be slavery. It lasted from 1820 to the 1850s. And those were the two main points. And you probably got this in grade school. Those were the two main points that he declared in 1857. And I think the best way to summarize that, a lot of people have attempted to summarize it, but I think the best way to summarize it is how Abraham Lincoln summarized it. In his Great House Divided speech, Abraham Lincoln said, "I believe this government cannot endure permanently, half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved permanently. I do not expect the House to fall, but I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will be either all one thing or all the other. Because if you stop and think about it, if you say Congress can't control slavery and where it is, well, Southerners can go to the North and take slaves, and the people in the North can go down to the South and try to do something. It just meant that all the compromises that had been attempted in the first 50 or 60 years were not going to work. It split the Democratic Party in a very short period of time. It even caused Lincoln again in his first inaugural to doubt how judicial review could work. It was just too cosmic to believe. And by the way, Judge Wells, to his credit, had decided the case very simply. He had said, "You know, these cases could be brought in state court, so why is there any question about whether they can be brought in federal court?" He had a very simple proposition in his. Now, I will, even though Ms. Jackson deferred, I will go ahead and give you just a few critical facts to understanding the state proceedings. And now I'm going to move over to the left of your chart and look at the state court proceedings that start in the Missouri Circuit Court. And again, this is a trial court. Despite its name, it is a trial court. And by the way, it is still today a trial court. And start to the left over there. And as you see, in 1846, Dred and Harriet file separate lawsuits. And that is probably a very good time for me to mention to you that most of the scholarship on this for many years, most of the scholarship talked about it as Dred Scott, Dred Scott, Dred Scott. Probably the way you were taught it. It's almost, and even in the official reports, they used the two names. They neglected Harriet. And I believe, based on the best scholarship, they neglected the two children. I believe one reason that Dred Scott was so intent on trying to get freedom was he was 50-ish. He was much older than Harriet. We're pretty sure of that. And I think he was worried about what would happen to the two daughters. Now, we have only the slightest inclination on that. The best scholarship on that is a professor at Iowa who wrote an article in 1997, a path-breaking article called Mrs. Dred Scott. Her name is Leah Vandervelde. She's since written a book, Dr. Moore would tell you, since written a book on that subject. But that's when it changed to thinking about the different reasons this might have been at that time. But I've got to tell you a few basic facts about Harriet and Dred. They had lived in in Wisconsin territory, in free territory. Fort Snelling, those of us who go to the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport, if you ever go there and start to drive in, it's right by the airport, right by the rivers, was where that fort was. And although there's some historical discrepancy, from 1834 to 1838, they had lived there. And as you know, that was free territory. It was free under the Northwest Ordinance. It was free by the Missouri Compromise. It was free about any way you could cut it, just to be frank about it. So the Scots said, we lived in free territory for years, and Harriet's master gave, that was the word he wrote in his own handwriting, gave Harriet to Dred to be married, that usually emancipated a slave, by the way, gave her to be married, and they were married in a ceremony he performed as the Indian agent for that area of the world. And so, therefore, they had many claims to freedom. The claims to freedom, they're just as many as you can cite. Now, when you're down here in the left-hand corner, notice that they file their petition in 1846. In 1847, they have their first trial, and their first trial was won by the owner, Emerson. You see the owner there winning the first trial. Now, the owner won on a technicality, and the judge immediately granted a new trial. Undeterred, the owner appealed to the Missouri Supreme Court. That's why it goes up there in 1848 and right back down. Do you see what I'm referring to? And it comes right back down to a second trial because the Missouri Supreme Court said, and by the way, they ruled in Harriet's case. They ruled in Harriet's case, you heard me. Something not noted for many years. And then entered the same thing in Dred's case. The Missouri Supreme Court said, hey, there's a new trial's been granted. Let's wait till we see what the new trial does. And so that is the so-called second trial, which occurs in 1850. And notice the words underneath 1850 say that who won that case? Dred Scott and Harriet Scott won that case before the jury. It may sound odd to you to think that they won, but Missouri had a law which said someone who had a claim to being free could file a suit called a freedom suit, a suit for freedom. And for the lawyers here, it's kind of like false imprisonment is the best thing I can tell you about. Kind of like you're being held against your will. You shouldn't be held. So that was the second trial. And the second trial, as you know then, as you can tell by the arrow, goes to the Missouri Supreme Court for its decision in 1852. And in 1852, the Missouri Supreme Court gets the case. There were three judges on the court. And if you'll take a second and go to the other handout I gave you, it's the one that has highlights on it. The highlighted judge, at that time the Missouri Supreme Court had three judges. Although the Constitution said they were holding sessions in Jefferson City, Judge Wolf will get a kick out of this, they did most of their business in St. Louis. But the highlighted judges were the three there. All three were born in Virginia. All three came to Missouri by way of Tennessee or Kentucky. And they then landed in Missouri. Ironically, they all three landed in the central of Missouri, center Missouri. And one of them, particularly Gamble, came back to St. Louis, but that's kind of trivial. But those three judges were the three who were on the Supreme Court. As you note in the second note on the page, not the first note, but the second note, these judges all refused to take a loyalty oath in 1862 and were purged from the bench. And then when the oath got even tougher, the next bunch of judges, that's the third note down on the left-hand column, the so-called ironclad oath, it went on for paragraphs. My clerk and I looked at this last week. It went on for paragraphs. Did you ever aid? Were you in sympathy with the enemy? Did you aid them? Did you aid bushwhacking? Did you aid all kinds of other stuff? It went on forever. But anyhow, my point is, those three were the three judges on the Missouri Supreme Court at that time. And it goes without saying, but I should make it very, 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 very plain that had the Missouri Supreme Court ruled for Scott, Dred Scott, and Harriet. By the way, my diagram here, I need to digress. My diagram here is from Fehrenbacher, who's at the bottom of the page. This digression's worth it, by the way. Trust me. At the bottom of the page, you see Don Fehrenbacher's book, The Dred Scott Case and Its Significance in American Law and Politics. Fehrenbacher was a Stanford professor who wrote this book in 1978. It won the Pulitzer Prize in history. It's still in print. It won the Pulitzer Prize in history in 1979. I think it's the single best book. It's very readable and very well documented. Dr. Moore is qualified to speak, and I'm not, but it appears to me to be very accurate and very well done in every regard. And if you have one thing to read, I would recommend that to you. It's his diagram I've given you, and it just hit me up here. It always happens when you speak, you know, that he uses the word Scott for Dred Scott, and he uses Harriet's first name. Although in some of the proceedings, I've got to tell you, they only use first names for the slaves, even if they had another last name that was apparent on the record. And many of these records, in many of these cases, there were. And while I'm digressing, I can tell you one more thing that's better than what I'll say later. That is, Washington University has for years been digitizing, putting on the internet, searchable, friendly, I don't know all the words to use for it, you get the point, the freedom suits that occurred here in Missouri. They're up over 300, we believe, is the latest count. And you can go on the website there, and you can see the way they're handwritten, the freedom suits are handwritten. You can see the way the judges wrote, again, the handwritten or however it was done. There are some printed documents is the reason I'm qualifying that. But it's just so impressive to look at those cases. And so I would recommend Washington. It's been graciously financed by many different foundations because it's been a big struggle, and there are probably still records there that we don't know about. These are in the state court here in mostly in the city of St. Louis is where they are. But why I'm here today, all the interesting asides aside, why I'm here today is to address directly the Missouri Supreme Court case, because as I started working this, I found that most of the historians did not address the Missouri Supreme Court case. The United States Supreme Court case, and you've already gotten the drift, was so cosmic and so big. I don't have the words to tell you how big it was. Some historians have argued that it caused the Civil War, period. Some have said it elected Abraham Lincoln in 1860. Other historians have quarreled with that, said that's too simplistic. Take Missouri, for example. On this side of Missouri, law was being pursued. The Dred Scott case was in the courts, right? Many of you know what was going on in western Missouri. Oh, my goodness. Probably the best way to make that clear to you would be to talk about the sack. Now, this is not the massacre at Lawrence, Kansas. This is the sack of Lawrence, Kansas, S-A-C-K. This is where 800 Missourians went over there and just tore the town apart. Best way to describe it. They threw all they could in the river there, and when they got tired of that, they burned everything else, you know, just for those purposes. So there are many, many causes and much violence. By the way, John Brown, 3 days after the sack of Kansas, retaliated by going down to a creek, Pottawatomie Creek, the edge of Kansas, and killing five pro-slavery adults to have something to do that day. So it was that kind of time. I don't want to be simplistic here about the causes. But if you stop and think about it, what the Dred Scott case at the top of your chart did was the Dred Scott case made legal means of solving the great standoff. There just weren't any legal recourse left, hardly. Lincoln tried to say some of it was dicta and other people did, and judicial review meant something different than it always meant, and a lot of things. But you understand that once the court says the two things I told you in the beginning, no Negro can be a citizen, Congress had no power to exclude slavery from the territories, that, you know, not much else was left besides violence. But what I'm here to talk to you about is to say that there could have been a much nicer end to the whole puzzle, especially for Dred and Harriet Scott, but even for our country, even for the United States of America. And I have three or four specific criticisms of what the Missouri Supreme Court did. And these are done respectfully. Judge Wolf and I served there. Of course, there was no error during that period of time. But during this period of time, let me talk to you about three or four. We'll see how the time goes. Let me talk to you about three or four parts of the Supreme Court decision. The lawyers and judges in the room know about stare decisis or precedent. It means that generally, let me quote Cardozo. I was going to give you a shorthand. Let me quote Benjamin Cardozo. He says, stare decisis is the everyday working rule of law. It is the process of search, comparison, and most of the times, a little more. The work of deciding cases in accordance with precedents that fit them is a process similar to deciding them with a statute. And then he tells us the reasons why. These were famous lectures he gave in the 1920s. Lewis Powell, Justice Powell of the Supreme Court, more recently put it this way. He said there were three advantages to stare decisis. One, to ease the burden on judges, lawyers, and litigants in figuring out what the law is. Two, to have stability in the law. And three, to enhance the public legitimacy and respect for the judiciary. Now, I know I quoted modern people, Justice Cardozo, modern by these historical standards, Justice Cardozo and Justice Powell, but Chief Justice Taney himself, in a case in 1851, just 6 years before the Scott's case, Chief Justice Taney had talked about, particularly in matters of property, stare decisis is the safe, I'm quoting him, is the safe and established rule and should always be adhered to. That's what he wrote a scant 6 years before. And that was the rule in Missouri courts, too. The Missouri courts shortly before this time had said that stare decisis was meant to be done. And later commentators, very famous commentators, have noted that in the 19th century, during this time, stare decisis was even more enforced than today. In the state court case, in the Missouri Supreme Court, 1852 case you see there, the Missouri Supreme Court overrules a long line of precedents without even discussing them. They don't even mention them. You can look in the, it's a fairly short opinion. You can look in the law books. It's fairly readable too, I might add. You can look there and see that there's a long line of cases they don't even mention. Let me give you a feel for them. In 1824, There was the case of the slave Winnie. She was a slave who was taken from Carolina to Illinois. Illinois is free, you know, free territory, and lived there 3 or 4 years. The master had the slave in Illinois 3 or 4 years, took her here to St. Louis to be sold. She sued for freedom. The Missouri Supreme Court unanimously said, by residence in Illinois, the slave owner lost the right in the property to the defendant. The right was removed by the Northwest Ordinance. That was the law that said no slavery north and west of the Ohio River, the Northwest Ordinance. It was passed by the Articles of Confederation Congress and repassed by the U.S. Congress. But anyhow, the Supreme Court clearly said, once a slave has a residence on free territory, then they're free. And if you think about the great compromise of that period, that had to be true. One side of the South, slavery was legal. It was illegal in the North. Otherwise, there'd be no rule. Of course, there were exceptions for so-called sojourning, just traveling through, and there were exceptions for runaways. But that aside, the Missouri Supreme Court said that in 1824, and then they turned around in 1828, and the court said the same thing, again, Illinois issue. In 1828, same point again in another case. 1833, yet another case. 1834, 1837, and of course, and Ms. Jackson's well aware, in 1836, there's a case called Rachel v. Walker. Listen to the facts of this case. An Army officer bought Rachel. He took her to Free Soil Fort Snelling. You've heard Fort Snelling before, right? That's where the Scots were. She was there for several years. They returned to St. Louis. The Missouri Supreme Court unanimously upheld her claim to freedom. They said she was in free territory that long, even with an Army officer, that there's no question that she must be free. In the Dred Scott case, no mention of this line of cases. They're just backhanded, very vague references, two of them to be precise, but no mentioning of the cases. As modern judges are wont to say, there was no funeral and no decent burial of that precedent. The judges went right by the line of cases. They do cite a couple of cases that they take comfort from, and few of the time I won't bore you with the details. One was an English case, and one was a previous United States Supreme Court case. But needless to say, they didn't have a dad burn thing. Pardon me, like the TV commercial. They didn't have anything to do with Missouri law. Missouri law, and it was very, very clear. And by the way, Fehrenbacher says, let me quote Fehrenbacher to you, and he's right, by the way. Quote, except in Missouri, in the Dred Scott case, there appears to be no decision of a Southern appellate court that denied a suit for freedom in a clear-cut case of permanent residence on free soil, unquote, says Fehrenbacher. The Missouri Supreme Court completely ignored precedent, and this is a cliffhanger, I'll tell you at the end why, completely ignored precedent. First big error. A second big error that the court went right by was that courts are supposed to talk about the issues that are presented in the case. Now, you've heard me describe how this case would proceeded from the left and up to the Missouri Supreme Court. It was about freedom. It was about whether they were being held. It was about the length of residence. It was about this established sort of stuff. Again, this was the rule. I won't give you the quotations. This was the rule in the United States courts, and this was the rule in the state courts, that a case should be restricted to what was argued. And we have Walter Ehrlich, and was he a St. Louis U professor? He was, who went to great lengths to demonstrate that the briefs involved in the case on which the case were decided had no attacks on the Missouri Compromise, the right of citizenship. It was purely about these facts of freedom and purely about how they were argued. It is true that in that century they had long oral arguments. By the way, in the Dred Scott Supreme Court case, There were 4 days of arguments in February of 1856, and then the Supreme Court put it off until after the election, and then had four more days of arguments in December of 1856. But in the Missouri Supreme Court, there was no argument, so there was nothing added. The Missouri Supreme Court, in other words, went way out of its way to even make this ruling. Let me quote, that is Ehrlich, Professor Ehrlich that I'm quoting here. He talks about when the briefs were filed. He talks about how it was put off for a while and how it came back to St. Louis to be tried the next time they had a docket here. Let me read you his words. The decision was not based upon the unbiased and genuine articles and points of law that the attorneys had presented in their briefs, but rather upon the judges' own prejudicial views toward the question that by now had become the main issue in the bitter partisan struggle in Missouri, slavery in the territories. Here, for the first time, politics was injected into the case, not by the parties, but by the judges of the Missouri Supreme Court in their intended decision. The judges decided, and by the way, we have notes where they'd for years been thinking about doing this. They'd been writing little notes to each other. Two of them had been writing notes back and forth to each other about how they really wanted to do this, overrule these old freedom cases. They just needed the right case to do it. So that's the second big criticism I have, is they went out of their way to inject a political issue in the case that was not there at all. A third bedrock of the judicial process is respect for the legislature. Let me quote Justice Breyer. Justice Breyer, his recent book, Active Liberty. Many of you have probably read Active Liberty. I recommend it to you. Little pocketbook, very readable. Justice Breyer says, see, I read this historical stuff that's not. Pardon me, Dr. Moore. That's why I have to brag on it when I get something from the lawyers that's very readable. But Justice Breyer says, even if a judge knows what the just result should be, that judge should not substitute his juster will for that of the people. In a constitutional democracy, a conviction on the part of the people is entitled to great respect. And, of course, that's not just Justice Breyer talking. That was the Taney Court's view. They had several cases where they had said it. And, of course, it was the view in the Missouri Supreme Court. In Scott versus Emerson, the Missouri Supreme Court never mentions, not once, the law on freedom suits. The legislature, the territorial legislature in Missouri, had passed a freedom suit law in 1807. It had been reenacted in 1824, 1835, 1841, and 1845. 5 times the legislature had passed, amended, tinkered with the freedom suit law. And the legislature meant there be freedom suits. And I don't have to tell you that the decision in the Dred Scott case, I'm trying to think of the right word here, there were some little possibilities of freedom suits, but it guts, that's the word, it guts the freedom suit law. It makes it, for most people, meaningless, just bluntly. David Koenig, many of you may know, the Washington University professor, he puts it this way. He says, even if Scott versus Emerson did not close all doors to freedom in Missouri, it did close the major one. And he's right about that. He's exactly right. So that is the tenor of what was going on. Now, you may think, well, why did the Missouri Supreme Court do this? Well, now, all of the judges there had owned slaves. And by the way, district judge from Missouri, Wells, he had owned slaves, had a big farm near Jefferson City. He claimed he lost money on the farming. That's why he had to be a lawyer and a judge. But he had owned slaves. But Missourians were very divided about that. Very, very divided. Wells wrote at the very time that he was working on the federal Dred Scott. Sorry, I'm skipping around here a little bit. I'm going to beat the time. But Wells wrote notes at the very time. He was not ignorant of how the freedom suit law should really work. So let's start going through some whys. I've told you the errors, and usually when there are these big of mistakes, there's a why. There's a reason for it. Judge Scott wrote the majority opinion in the Missouri Supreme Court. Of course, needless to say, he's the one in your chart who wouldn't take any of these oaths. He is the William Scott, who had served in the Supreme Court from 1851 to 1862, and he was the author of the Dred Scott case in Missouri. He believed that, of course, he was a slaveholder, and of course, he was for the Confederacy. That goes without saying. But it was his whole way of life and thinking about things. For example, the Dred Scott opinion, which I told you does not mention the freedom laws, which I told you does not mention the long line, which doesn't tell you the lawyers didn't even argue these points, has a convoluted paragraph in which he tries to make the argument that God meant this to be the way. He does have that paragraph for sure, a long, and like I say, it's pretty convoluted. And the reason I'm kind of dismissive of it is that Judge Tompkins, who was the leading judge, he's on your chart. Now, we drew lines through these just so you can see them. Tompkins is the fifth one down there. The lines doesn't mean they didn't serve. That's so you can see the three who serve. We try to make this easier for you to see these obscure names. The names are obscure till you get over to Wolf and Benton in the right-hand column toward the bottom. But anyhow, Judge Tompkins had written opinions, and of course, he had claimed the opposite. He had claimed, of course, that Christianity meant you shouldn't have slavery. I'll leave that to the theologians, the bottom line of in your own beliefs of what it was, but that's a pretty bad basis. I think probably the best way to let you know why the Missouri Supreme Court did this and why they helped inflict all the rest of this on everybody else is probably to let Judge Scott speak for himself. And here's how he ends the opinion. Times are not now as they were when former decisions on this subject were made. Since then, not only individuals, but states have been possessed with a dark and fell spirit in relation to slavery, the gratification of which is sought in the pursuit of measures whose inevitable consequence is the overthrow and destruction of our government in Missouri. Under these circumstances, and I'm going to paraphrase a little bit here, Missouri should not show the least countenance to any measure that gratifies that spirit. Missouri is willing to accept her responsibility for the existence of slavery, but Missouri does not seek to divide and share it with others. We regret that the avarice and hard-heartedness of the progenitors of the free state people introduced slavery, but we will not go to them to learn law, morality, or religion. That is the way he ends the opinion. You understand what he's saying. Slavery began with great Northeastern support, banking support, that kind of thing. And we're just down the road several, 80, I figure the years however you want to. The international trade stopped in 1806. But we're just a few years down the road from that. So let's don't listen to them one bit. So there's just no question that they felt like it was to Judge Scott felt as if it was the way to preserve his way of looking at the world and injected that in the case. Wasn't at all the issue. By the way, just to give you a raw number, the best numbers are that in freedom suits, the slaves want about 3/4 of them. Yes, the slaves won. Now, of course, it was an arduous task. They had to write the petition. They had to get somebody to post a bond at some point in later days in Missouri. This was not easy. But the slaves won about 3/4 of them. You would not think that reading Judge Scott's opinion, just as a shorthand. Now, the vote in the Missouri Supreme Court was 2-1. There was a dissenter. The Chief Justice of the court was Hamilton R. Gamble, and he very dispassionately, that's the right word, very dispassionately reviewed the previous Missouri cases. He counseled some detachment from the situation. He said simply, and he'd talked about the cases, unlike the majority, he said, where a right to freedom has been acquired under the law of another state, it may be enforced by action in the courts of a slaveholding state. In every one of these cases, the party claiming freedom had not gotten a court judgment. I'm summarizing here again for the modern terms. Had not gotten a judgment or done anything special except live there. Here's his answer to Judge Scott. It ends Gamble's opinion. And he says, times may have changed, public feeling may have changed, but principles have not and do not change. In my judgment, there can be no safe basis for judicial decisions but in these principles, which are immutable. And so he ended up, he had represented slaveholders. He himself had owned slaves. And by the way, it was very fashionable that time for when people like Chief Justice Taney were appointed to public positions to sell or give up their slaves. To free their slaves, I should say that more specifically. But even so, he said, this is the way it has to be. And that is what I would commend to you. Now, of course, what happened was, to complete the story, after the Missouri Supreme Court case of 1852, there was a potential of direct appeal to Supreme Court. You notice there's blank space, right? You all got that? There's blank space. You can fold the page. There is blank space between the state court proceedings and the Supreme Court, the federal proceedings, right? The state proceedings are Southwest, I got it right, and the federal proceedings are Northeast. Everybody follow me on that? Right? There was, even in that day, the potential of an appeal to the Supreme Court. The scholars are not sure why there wasn't an appeal. Dred Scott was changing attorneys throughout this time, and as you rightly pointed out, the Blow family was helping at every stage. They're the ones who eventually bought the freedom for the family. But they were changing attorneys at the time, was part of it. You know, appealing to the Supreme Court in that posture where state court had said something, that, you know, that was a pretty weak claim in that time. But Harriet and Dred's family then did decide to sue in the federal court, and that is the circuit court proceeding on the right-hand side of your page. Judge Wells thought it was rather straightforward. Of course, Harriet and Dred could sue, but the Missouri Supreme Court had ruled, and this was a diversity case. And the lawyers here, those are bing, bing words. That's what's the magic word. This is the magic word for today, is a diversity case, because the Sanford, by the way, the name is misspelled. It was S-A-N-F-O-R-D. It's not misspelled here. It was misspelled by the United States Supreme Court. Please understand. But this is because Sanford was out of state. Scott was a Missourian. The Scotts were Missourians. And so Judge Wells believed it was relatively straightforward. When it got to Taney, Taney said, no, we've got to look first at the issue of whether these are even human beings who are in the court here. And that's when he issued his two rulings. No Negro can ever be a citizen. He kind of implied they couldn't even be citizen of a state. That's the better scholarship, in my view. But they were definitely not ever going to be a federal citizen, and they couldn't get into court by diversity jurisdiction. Congress could not really control slavery anymore. And as they say, the rest is history. Great to be with you.
Turn on the audio visual while you talk. Sorry.
Our next speaker is Dr. Robert Moore. Dr. Moore by way of his background, he holds a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree from Syracuse University and both a Master's and PhD degrees in history from Washington University in St. Louis. He has been employed by the National Park Service for more than 25 years. He has worked at such famous battlegrounds as Saratoga, Yorktown, Morristown, and Gettysburg. He has been the historian for the National Park Service at the Jefferson National Expansion Memorial in St. Louis since 1991. And he is the author of some 8 books, including a book on the Gateway Arch, published in 2005. Dr. Robert Moore.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming, everyone, today. And I also wanted to thank Rachel Marshall for organizing the wonderful program this afternoon. Maybe we could give her a little round of applause here. I guess my thing is on the wrong slide here. Let's see if I can make it switch. There we go. It popped in really quick. And second, before I start the main course of my remarks, I wanted to extend a thank you to Mike Everman and his staff at the State of Missouri's St. Louis Courts Record Project. Is anyone here from the project today, Mike or any of his folks? I know he was going to try to be here, but apparently they weren't able to make it. It's really due to the hard work of Mike and his staff that the old records, which I'm going to be talking about this afternoon, were cleaned and organized and made available to researchers for projects such as this. They all are incredibly knowledgeable there about the collection, and this is the records are currently housed in the old Globe Democrat building on Tucker. And they're always available for discussions and consultations about the collection and the evidence available contained within it. This afternoon, my part of the program is going to be a little more based around the history rather than the legal side, so I hope you'll bear with me and it's not too little legal content for you. I began researching in the St. Louis Court Records Collection in 1991, when it was still housed in the Civil Courts building at the corner of Market and Tucker Streets. The collection was being kept at that time purely as a set of court records. That is, it wasn't viewed or cared for as an archival collection at all, but merely stored under the best conditions possible in the event that a lawyer or a judge wanted to retrieve an old case file for reference purposes in relation to modern-day cases. Through no fault of the court, the storage space for the collection was substandard at best and had no heating and air conditioning controls or humidity controls. Decades of dust, soot, and grime had settled on the files, which were stored on open shelving, along with other items not related to the collection, which I couldn't quite figure out. They included some sorts of biological specimens of an unidentified nature, which were stored in bottles of formaldehyde. Access to the files for researchers was allowed in between the normal work of the court records office, and so that could be sporadic. There were few security controls in place. The files were disorganized, and only the chief file clerk, Mel Conley, bless her, could locate an individual file very easily. So a question might come up, why research in these old records? It didn't take me very long when I started to realize the enormous importance of this collection. Nationwide, many court records have been lost through negligence, fires, floods, or just plain being thrown away to make more space. Luckily, none of these pitfalls befell the St. Louis court collection, which today survives nearly intact, with records dating from its inception in 1804 down through the present day. The 19th century records are unique because of St. Louis's position during that century as the last major city on the way to the American West, Its central location on the inland waterways of the Missouri-Mississippi-Ohio River system, its importance as a fur trade center, steamboat port, manufacturing depot, outfitting point for the Overland Trails, negotiation site for American Indian treaties, and point of origin for expeditions of exploration. In addition, St. Louis was in a slave state that bordered a free state, making cases involving slavery, particularly slave suits for freedom, common. All of these factors made St. Louis unique, and its court records reflect that uniqueness. Nowhere else in the country is there a collection of court records that covers early Western history, slavery, national migration, and immigration to the extent that this collection does. My research into slavery in St. Louis during the antebellum period, which we'll cover today, was heavily dependent on these records. Many others are now also using this incredible resource to research African American life. This is a very good thing. Many slaves of the period were illiterate, and we would not know many of the stories that have now come to light without these unique court records. One of the most important finds in recent years resulted from research by historian Chris Zapalak into the 1855 attempt by a number of slaves, possibly assisted by a free African-American St. Louisan named Mary Meacham, to escape across the Mississippi River to Illinois and northward on the Underground Railroad. The case against Mary Meacham generated by these events provided some of the first concrete evidence of Underground Railroad activity in the state of Missouri. Further, it resulted in the crossing site in North St. Louis being designated as Missouri's first official landmark on the federal government, the National Park Service's Underground Railroad Network to Freedom. Thus, a piece of historical evidence from the archival collections of the St. Louis courts evolved into a designated historical site, which is now visited by the public to learn more about the Underground Railroad. Since the Missouri State Archives has assumed the responsibility for the care and restoration of these records, there have been vast improvements in their storage, preservation, security, and accessibility to researchers. The ability to retrieve records, their physical condition, and the availability of records via the web, which was discussed earlier, are all overwhelmingly positive changes due directly to this project. A keyword searchable database case file makes locating specific files and types of cases easy, and the availability of color images of the documents makes reviewing them much quicker and eliminates damage to the originals. By the way, these two websites, one of them being the National Park Service's, the others being the St. Louis Court Records site that's maintained by Washington University, are two places where you can go, and they're both cross-linked with one another to find out more information about all the things that I'm discussing today. The informational value of finding aids on the web is essential to the efficient use of these documents. The enormous and daunting size of the collection has not deterred the workers on the project, who have proceeded to process the surviving records in chronological order. The incredible importance of this collection makes it imperative that the work on these records proceed to the conclusion of the 19th century. So over the next few minutes, I'd like to tell you some stories of individuals that have been culled from specific records or pieced together from the totality of records on an individual type of court action of the period. I'd like to begin with the story from which the title of today's program is derived, They Love Liberty. It's a phrase often found in the abolition newspaper called The Liberator, which was published during this period, but not often seen in the newspapers of St. Louis. It seems like a pretty obvious phrase to us today that those held in bondage would love or yearn for liberty. So why does this phrase stand out in the story that I'll tell you today? St. Louis newspapers of the antebellum era ranged from racist to pro-slavery to silent witnesses during this period. There were no anti-slavery papers save one, and its editor, Elijah P. Lovejoy, was forced to move from St. Louis due to the public uproar he caused and was later martyred in Alton, Illinois for his beliefs. After Lovejoy's death in 1837, a law was passed in Missouri making it illegal to publish any abolitionist book, article, pamphlet, or newspaper. So it was quite surprising to me to see the phrase, "They love liberty," in an 1844 St. Louis newspaper, and even more startling to read the context of its use. In researching official court-ordered sales of slaves that took place in antebellum St. Louis, and enumerating those that took place on the steps of the courthouse, I ran across a newspaper advertisement offering a $200 reward for the return of four runaway persons, a family consisting of John, who was about 35 years of age, his wife Lucy, about 30, and their two children, 2 and 5 years old. This is not it, by the way, that's on the screen right now. This was a newspaper advertisement. This was not an unusual advertisement, pretty common, actually, but these slaves, who were supposed to be sold on the steps of the courthouse as part of an estate settlement, were long gone from the St. Louis area by the time this advertisement was published. Over a month later, an article appeared in the same newspaper stating that the enslaver of Lucy and her two children had received a most amazing letter from Chicago. He had sent a slave hunter to Chicago to find the escaping family with no success. The letter, as printed in the newspaper, read, "Dear Sir, I have the satisfaction to inform you that John and Lucy arrived safely here via the Underground Railroad and have left for Canada by steam. They love liberty and are among friends. I communicate this information that you may be relieved of further expense in their behalf. Is it not your duty to dissolve your connection with slavery? Truly yours, etc., anti-slavery." The newspaper editorialized, "This is a specimen of the humor indulged in after a success by the canting, skulking, skin-dried hirelings in the employ of the Central Society, a hive of hornets which is stinging the country into fever, if not frenzy. We have headed our article with an offer of $1,000 reward. We might make it $5,000 and get it subscribed immediately for the rending open of the foul nest and the neck-wringing of the brood, which has darkly thriven amongst us. The Underground Railroad has been employed with considerable success, and its conductors don't exactly carry their badges on their hats, but they may find, when they least expect it, a wrong passenger on the track. $1,000 for the discovery of the depot." Desperate to find the persons responsible for the escapes to freedom from St. Louis, and there were many, the newspaper offered substantial amounts of money to find them. They could not seem to believe that a smoothly operating underground railroad could possibly operate without white help, and their references to a foul nest are centered on a conspiracy among a suspected coterie of abolitionist whites who secretly helped to spirit slaves away from St. Louis. Interestingly, most of those actually named in the newspapers, some of whom were later put on trial and are in the court records as suspected agents, were not white, but primarily they were free persons of color who lived in St. Louis. A series of indictments for enticing or decoying a slave out of the state were handed down against John Price, Stephen Stamps, Isaac Dean, Simon Dickens, and Polly, described as a free woman of color, between 1844 and 1846 alone, with Isaac Dean, a mulatto, being viewed, according to the newspapers, as the chief conspirator. Dean was so hated that the venue of his trial was moved out of the St. Louis courts to St. Charles. It's important in telling the story of African American life in St. Louis to understand how deep the hatred and frustration caused by abolitionist conspiracies or suspected conspiracies ran in the community. Harsher and harsher laws were passed with the goal of forcing obedience and stasis in the enslaved portion of the community, while at the same time placing greater restrictions on an ever-growing body of free persons of color. It was the free black community over which the slave owners obsessed, as we shall see. On July 9, 1841, four African-American men were convicted of murder, arson, and burglary committed during a bank robbery in St. Louis, and were hanged at Duncan's Island just south of the city. Thousands turned out to catch a glimpse of the unprecedented multiple execution, and day trips were advertised on steamboats to ferry people to the scene. One of the four men was a slave and the others were free. The bank robbery involved two gruesome murders. In his confession narrative, one of the four, Charles Brown, revealed that he was a paid agent of the Ohio Anti-Slavery Society and provided details regarding the inner workings of abolitionist organizations. Brown claimed that it had been his job to visit cities such as St. Louis, locate potential runaways, and persuade them to escape north. Forged papers and money for the escapes were provided by the society. Brown and his cohorts frightened white St. Louisans of 1841 because they were intelligent, educated, and literate. White fears were exacerbated greatly by the confessions of the four and contributed to harsher state laws enacted in 1845 and 1847. The African-American community was unnerved by the public display of the severed heads of the four men who were executed in the window of Course's drugstore on Main Street. I became involved in research about slavery in St. Louis due to the story of Dred Scott that we've been talking about so far this afternoon, an enslaved man who petitioned for his freedom in St. Louis's old courthouse in 1846, shortly after all of the incidents I've just been speaking about. With this background and context to his suit, I felt for the first time the raw courage it took to take legal action against a white person in antebellum Missouri and to try to break the bonds of slavery to become a member of the hated and feared free black community in the city. In another respect, it became apparent immediately when looking at the original documents that Dred Scott did not petition alone. And we've already gone over this a little bit, the fact that on the same day, at the same time as Dred presented his petition to the court, his wife Harriet, with a separate set of documents and in a separate suit, also petitioned for her freedom. Several historians have theorized that Harriet's role in the Scott's freedom suit had a more solid legal basis than that of her husband. Yet the case has gone down in history as the Dred Scott decision. To understand the reasons why Harriet was more than likely an important force in the case, I'd like to describe a bit about the lives of African-American women in antebellum St. Louis and the conditions which made their servitude more dangerous and onerous than that of men. It's hard to pigeonhole the African-American experience in St. Louis, where some women of color were enslaved, others were free, and some, like Madame Pelagie Rutgers, were rich. The slave system, in which most African-American women were ensnared, was based on the color of a person's skin, but mostly on bloodlines. Put simply, the child of a female slave was also a slave for life. In one St. Louis slave suit for freedom, a woman with as little as 1/16th African blood was considered to be a slave. African Americans were a part of the St. Louis area from the time of its first European settlement in 1764. Many slaves who had been born and lived under the French and Spanish systems in the 18th century were in for a rude shock when the United States occupation began in 1804, when the so-called Black Laws added far more restrictive regulations to slave life, including the proviso that all African Americans, free and slave, carry passes. And of course, the big changeover at this period was between civil law, which was the system of law under the French and Spanish, and common law, the English common law, which was the system under the Americans. When most people think of slavery today, they generally think of a house servant on a big plantation or a field worker picking cotton or planting tobacco. But life in cities like St. Louis was different for African Americans than life on rural plantations. The opportunities for interaction with whites and free blacks were constant in the cities, as were those for greater freedom within their slave status than they would have had on an isolated plantation. By 1835, an African-American church had started in St. Louis. Sundays were also days of rest for the slaves, when gossip and news could be passed from one person to another, in or out of church. Former St. Louis slave Henry Clay Bruce reported that, quote, "A colored man who could read was a very important fellow, for the slaves would come miles and bring stolen papers for him to read to them at night or on Sunday." All these circumstances made urban slavery unusual and created a situation in which a person could earn enough money to purchase themselves from slavery and even work their way up the social ladder within the free black community. At first glance, this different form of slave life might seem more humane and just, but evidence suggests regarding the brutality and harshness of life in St. Louis. Newspapers contained almost daily notices of runaways. Instability was the one factor which characterized the lives of slaves, and brutality was a clear motivation for wanting to escape from involuntary servitude. Families were often divided, and rebellious slaves were sold down the river. Because slavery in St. Louis became less and less profitable as years went by, enslavers hired out their slaves without a transfer of ownership, usually for periods of a year at a time. Like the buying and selling of slaves, hiring became a business. A class of brokers developed, operating under the name of agents. They would hire slaves and serve as middlemen. St. Louis slaves were most commonly used as laborers, draymen, washerwomen, and domestics. The reason slavery was unprofitable in the cities was that the price of a slave could also pay the wages of a free common laborer for several years without the necessity of furnishing food, board, shelter, health care, and clothing. And there were a lot of free common laborers in St. Louis due to the huge waves of immigration during the period. In fact, by the 1840s, many enslavers not only hired out their slaves, but also illegally allowed them to hire themselves out and find their own lodgings. This unusual state of affairs taught specific African Americans to fend for themselves, to market their abilities wisely, and to be thrifty with their money. They often were able to save a cut of the fees paid to their enslaver for themselves. They were able to live fairly autonomous lives within the strict black codes and racial hierarchy of Missouri law. This was the positive side of hiring out. On the negative side, those hired out to specific persons for a year's service had constant apprehension about who they would be working for, and more importantly, under whose control they would literally be, body and soul. This situation presented more problems for female slaves than for males. Harriet Jacobs, a slave of North Carolina, stated that, quote, "The rape of a slave was not a crime, but a trespass upon her master's property." A slave woman could be taken by her master as a concubine, forced into sexual relations, or raped with no penalty, and the large number of mulatto children described in the St. Louis court records bear testimony to this. Each person in official documents was described with a particular shade of color: copper, bronze, dark, light, mulatto, quadroon, octoroon. In fact, Dred and Harriet Scott were some of the few persons I've ever seen in the St. Louis court documents described as being pure African. Slave children brought up under such circumstances must have experienced a strange sort of extended family, hard to imagine today. Harriet Jacobs recalled that, quote, "My master was, to my knowledge, the father of 11 slaves. But did the mothers dare to tell who was the father of their children? No, indeed. They knew too well the terrible consequences." St. Louis slave William Wells Brown recalled that, quote, "My mother's name was Elizabeth. She had 7 children. No 2 of us were children of the same father. My father's name, as I learned from my mother, was George Higgins. He was a white man, a relative of my master." The high proportion of suits for freedom instituted by women in St. Louis may be due to the special forms of duress they suffered. Examples of this stress abound, and there were some particularly spectacular and gruesome cases. In a famous Missouri case of 1855, State v. Celia, it was proven that a slave woman, forced to have sexual relations with her master and bear his children, killed him with a stick and burned his body in the fireplace of her cabin. She was caught, tried, and hanged in 1855. A woman named Margaret in Cole County, Missouri, killed her own baby by severing its umbilical cord in 1848. And when a Marion County woman's 3 small sons were purchased in 1834 and were due to be taken from her, she beheaded them all and committed suicide with an axe. Better to die and kill your children than to condemn them to a life of servitude and rape. Better to kill your master than to allow the chain of breeding new slaves to continue. Slave auctions and sales in St. Louis were commonplace, and a constant reminder that those who did not toe the line could be sold down the river, literally, taken away from their families and forced to hard labor in the fields of plantations in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Sales were held in several places, most notably at the slave market run by Bernard Lynch on Locust Street between 4th and 5th. This market was later moved in 1859 to Broadway and Clark Streets, just about where the stadium is today. These locations are where the majority of all slaves bought and sold in the city were handled. Large numbers of slaves, most of them not from St. Louis, were herded off steamboats and up the street to the slave houses, then sold to persons, especially after 1840, from outside the city, mostly from the western counties in Missouri or further down the river. Few slaves were purchased by people who lived in St. Louis for the reasons already outlined. However, many persons found that the slaves had to be sold in accordance, that slaves sometimes had to be sold in accordance with probate law. Since slaves were considered to be property, when a person died without a will or an estate had to be equitably divided between large or odd numbers of beneficiaries, the probate court stepped in and sold slave property on the steps of the courthouse. We have taken the time to find and record each and every slave sold on the steps during the 19th century, and the results of that inquiry are online on our website. Historian Miel Wilson painstakingly combed the original records and arrived at a count of 533 individuals who appear in the St. Louis court documents as having been offered for sale on the St. Louis court steps. A total of 724 slaves are mentioned in the probate court records in connection with slave sales, but nearly 200 of that number were auctioned in places other than at the courthouse. Each of these individuals can be found on our website, including the amount of money paid for their purchase. A special thanks should also be extended to the St. Louis Probate Court and its head, Greg Ingram, for access to these records and his personal efforts to see this project succeed. As I mentioned earlier, the small community of enslaved persons in St. Louis was dwindling during the 19th century, even as the community of free persons of color was growing. A slave could be emancipated voluntarily by their enslaver, although I believe this rarely happened. A slave was a valuable piece of property, even if the sale of their services was becoming less and less valued. African Americans in St. Louis usually purchased their own freedom out through the wages that they earned for working while hiring themselves out or for Sunday work, gardening, sewing, laundering, and other occupations. This was a very long process. In 1855, a 37-year-old slave named Elizabeth Keckley, who you see here, who was valued for her needlework, was able to borrow enough money from her clients to purchase her freedom and that of her 16-year-old son. She paid a total of $1,200, which would be over $40,000 in today's money. She left St. Louis for the East and became Mary Todd Lincoln's seamstress in the White House. Throughout the Civil War, Keckley continued to pay off her debt to St. Louis creditors, even after her boy died of disease while fighting for the Union cause during the Civil War. In court records, I've discovered a total of 982 recorded emancipations in St. Louis between 1830 and 1860, among a slave population which never exceeded 2,500. So again, almost 1,000 emancipations out of 2,500 people. Of these, over half were women. Once freed, some of these African Americans were able to make large investments and profits, especially in the real estate business. Several owned large barber emporiums, which were frequented by all the important white men of the town. Others owned drayage businesses, which moved goods from steamboat to steamboat on the levee. Still others took in laundry, a very lucrative trade practiced by, among many others, Harriet Scott. The rise in the population of free blacks, as we mentioned earlier, worried St. Louis slave owners. It was generally believed that free blacks stirred up discontent among the slaves and caused them to run away, slow down their work, or sue for their freedom if they were eligible. Despite certain successes, life was harsh even for free blacks. They were not considered to be citizens and could not vote. After 1847, their children, by law, could not attend school. By law, a free man or woman of color had to have a license with them at all times as proof that they were free. If caught without a license, the African American was thrown into the jail, then brought up before the Board of County Commissioners, a panel of three judges who would decide their fate. And I should mention here that the first school built in St. Louis, the first free public school building, was built on land purchased from a free black woman, and her children could not attend that school after it was built. Once emancipated, all free blacks in St. Louis had to apply for a license before the board within one calendar year of their freedom under a law passed in 1835. The act was yet another hurdle that African Americans living in Missouri had to overcome. Not only did they have to go to the court and possess the qualifications to apply for a freedom license, but the applicant also had to be either born in Missouri or prove that they, quote, were residents of this state on the 7th day of January in the year 1825, continue to be such residents at the taking effect of this act, and produce satisfactory evidence that they are of the class of persons who may obtain such license, that they are of good character and behavior, and capable of supporting themselves by lawful employment, that the court may grant them a license to reside within the state. We also investigated thoroughly the entries in the county court record books that chronicle the appearances by former slaves to obtain licenses, and this was a very fascinating journey. On July 31, 1840, for instance, several African Americans were granted licenses which gave them the right to reside within Missouri. They included Delali, a 51-year-old woman who stood less than 5 feet tall, whose occupation was washerwoman. Sally Hazlitt, a 17-year-old quadroon, worked as a seamstress, and even though she had only one grandparent that was of African descent, she had to apply for a license to live in the state. Later the same day, St. Louis lawyer Ferdinand Risk asked that licenses be granted to 39 other African Americans, but this request was refused. This meant that these 39 people had to leave the state of Missouri or be subject to a fine or punishment. And I should mention quickly that Ferdinand Risk is one of the lawyers that worked in St. Louis who sort of specialized in taking freedom suits. He and another attorney, Gustavus Byrd, were known using the N-word as the Negro, not using the word Negro, lawyers called that in the newspapers of the time. So it isn't surprising to me that Risk was denied his request before that particular judge in 1840. In that same spring of 1840, a woman named Catherine Harris was arrested by the sheriff for having no license to stay within the state. Further, she had no money to pay the $10 fine, so she was thrown into the jail. While in jail, the accumulated costs for her room and board mounted and were tacked on to her indebtedness to the state. By the time the Board of County Commissioners heard her case, in June of 1840, she owed $33.25. Because she still had no money to pay this fine, the court ordered her to be hired out by the sheriff until such wages as accrued would cover her debt. At that point, she would be evicted from the state. But Catherine's case didn't end there. 5 days later, she was once more brought before the court because the sheriff hadn't been able to hire her out. No one had wanted her services. Perhaps she was too old or frail or mentally incompetent. The record doesn't say. The law had a provision to cover cases such as these, and the court exercised it. It was ordered that Catherine Harris should have 19 lashes laid on her bare back by the sheriff in a public punishment and then be expelled from the state. All told, the licensing of free African Americans encompassed the period from December 1835 to May 1863. Yes, even during the Civil War, people still had to obtain licenses to reside in Missouri if they were free persons of color. During that period, 1,492 people were approved to receive a freedom license by the St. Louis County Court. A larger number of freedom license recipients were men, possibly heads of households. There were 806 male applicants and 686 female applicants. The records kept when a person of color applied for a freedom license are important to us today because they included information about each person not available elsewhere. the person's name, age, height or size, and a physical description including complexion, scars, and any physical deformities was recorded. This was done so that the person receiving the freedom license could have documentation proving that the license was theirs, and so that the license could not be given to or used by another. Sometimes the license record also included information about children, parents, and spouses. One of the most interesting aspects of the freedom license records is the recording of the occupations of the applicants. Of the 63 various occupations listed, we see a cross-section of the African-American community of the period, an insight into the types of work enslaved and free persons were involved in. There were some whose job was a skilled trade, such as blacksmiths, whitewashers, plasterers, carpenters, butchers, engineers, and nurses. Interestingly enough, there was even a doctor, a lawyer, and a pilot, all highly skilled professions listed among the careers of freedom license applicants. The most common jobs among the women, as you can see from the chart, were washerwomen, chambermaids, and seamstresses. The most common jobs among the men were as boat hands, stewards, and barbers. In 1843, the state of Missouri tightened the screws on free persons of color by demanding that henceforth persons applying for freedom licenses had to obtain a bond of up to $1,000, the exact amount was dictated by the court, ensuring that they were of good moral character and would uphold the laws of the state. If the person was convicted of any crime, they had to pay the amount on the bond and would have their license forfeited and have to depart from the state. The securities mentioned in the law were individuals who could attest to the good behavior of the person applying for the license. If the person on the license were convicted of any crime, the securities also risked their money and reputations. They would be charged with having to pay the amount on the bond. If the bond was not paid, property could be confiscated and sold to pay the debt to the state. Some of the persons who acted as securities did so multiple times for many different individuals. The securities did not have to meet any special qualifications. For instance, they didn't have to be white, they didn't have to be lawyers. They could be co-workers, family members, a former enslaver, friends, or employers. An interesting story that we found connected with securities for freedom licenses was discovered in the record for David Combs and his wife, Anna Combs. They received their licenses on April 22, 1861, shortly after Fort Sumter. In the freedom license record, David's occupation was listed as being a worker in a mustard factory. The bonds for David and his wife were $500 each. The man who stood as the security for David and his wife was E.W. Holloway. The 1860s U.S. Census revealed that E.W. Holloway was a white laborer, originally from Ohio. It also listed him as being employed in a mustard factory. We can only conjecture, but there must have been a great amount of trust and respect on the part of this white man, co-worker, and friend to stand as security for a black man and his wife in a slave state just as the Civil War was beginning and to put up a $1,000 bond for their freedom. It's interesting to look at the number of free persons of color living in St. Louis according to the census and then look at the number of free persons who possessed a freedom license at the same time. At no time were all of the free persons of color in St. Louis actually licensed. During the 1830s, there were about 220 free blacks in the city. Between 1835 and 1840, there were 171 freedom licenses issued. The 1840 U.S. Census reported that 531 free persons of color lived in St. Louis, and by 1850, there were 1,398. Yet by 1850, only 789 freedom licenses had been issued by the county court. The 1860 census reported that 1,755 free persons of color were living in St. Louis, while only 1,048 were holders of freedom licenses. Consequently, as the number of free persons of color grew, the number of freedom licenses also grew, but the number of licenses issued never matched the reported free black population in the city. The court records show that 457 people were caught without a license during this period. 132 of these individuals were apprehended multiple times, some up to five times, receiving lashes as punishment for each instance, and each time ordered to depart from the state. Apparently, several of them never left. Although the state of Missouri tried in many ways to discourage free persons of color from coming into the state or remaining in the state after they obtained their freedom, they did not succeed. They simply made the process more difficult for these individuals. Those who championed the laws of 1835, 1843, and 1847 in the state of Missouri did not seem to expect that free persons of color would have the support and resources required to obtain licenses. As we've seen, there were many ways in which a person might escape from slavery. They could run away along the Underground Railroad, or they could purchase their freedom if they could earn enough money. Another avenue of escape from slavery was to use the legal system to sue for freedom, as Dred and Harriet Scott did in 1846. Many slaves found that, at one time or another, they'd lived in free territory, especially in Illinois, with their enslavers. St. Louis was a town in which persons of color could find out how to sue for one's freedom and which lawyers would be most amenable to taking on such a suit. Most people know that Dred and Harriet Scott sued Irene Emerson for their freedom in 1846, but few understand how a slave, a person with few legal rights, could sue their enslaver and take them to court. We just had this described to us, that there was a law made in the Louisiana Territory and later one in the state of Missouri in 1824, which allowed people to sue for freedom if they had a legal basis to put that on. For instance, that the enslaved person had been emancipated or had papers or witnesses to prove it, or that they had descended in the maternal line from a free woman of color, or that they had Indian blood in them. If the petition warranted it, the court permitted the institution of an action of trespass, assault and battery, and false imprisonment. The statute directed the court to protect the petitioner from abuse because of the suit, and if the petitioner was in danger of cruelty or removal from the court's jurisdiction, the court could issue a writ of habeas corpus. Should the enslaver refuse to post a bond, the slave was to be hired out for wages by the court. The court would also provide counsel if the person could not afford it. Now, as we know, Missouri bordered several states and territories that prohibited slavery. Many slaves used for their freedom in, Many slaves sued for their freedom in St. Louis based on the fact that they had lived for a time in Illinois, where slavery was prohibited, before being brought to Missouri. We now know that just over 300 slaves in St. Louis, not statewide, but just in St. Louis, there were a larger number if we go statewide, used this law to sue for their freedom between 1812 and 1865. We know that less than half won their cases. Could be a little more than half. It's around 50-50. Of those who sued, my estimate is that over 62%, from looking at the names, were women. And I think chiefly because a woman not only sought freedom from herself as a construct, but also freedom from fear of rape, freedom for her children, and freedom from the knowledge that her body would no longer be a breeding ground for future slaves. The overall number of slave suits probably stayed as low as it did due to several factors. These included the fear of white domination and retribution, the strict criteria under which a slave was eligible for freedom, and the knowledge of the rigors which would have to be endured during the pendency of such a suit. Incarceration in a cold, damp cell, being hired out to a high bidder with an uncertain fate while the suit was in progress, and the need to find a sympathetic lawyer to steer the enslaved person through a complicated legal system were all part of the process. The length of time a suit might take was indeterminate and sometimes extended over several years. For example, the case of Pierre V. Chodo began in 1841 and was not settled until 1867. 2 years after the end of the Civil War. Incarceration could be debilitating and at times life-threatening. Lucy Delaney, a woman who wrote an account of her experiences in suing for her freedom as a teenage girl in 1843, recorded that, "I was put in a cell under lock and key and remained for 17 long and dreary months, listening to the foreign echoes from the street." Imagine being put in jail at age 16 or 17, for over a year. An existing record from the St. Louis Circuit Court provides even more information about Lucy's incarceration, stating that she was, quote, "suffering from a severe cold occasioned, as she believes, from a deficiency of clothing and the dampness of the room in which she is confined, and that had it not been for the careful attention of her mother, who visited her frequently, her sufferings would have been incalculable. Although the jailer made an inspection by order of the court, he reported the following day that Lucy was, quote, well-clothed and comfortably lodged, an unbelievable claim considering the swiftness of the supposed change. 3 years later, a slave named Eliza and her infant daughter actually died in the St. Louis jail due to the long term of their incarceration under primitive conditions and the inability of the sheriff to hire them out. Another danger to African Americans suing for their freedom was kidnapping. Enslavers or their agents frequently kidnapped slaves to remove them from the jurisdiction of the court while their suits were pending. Although illegal, this practice was never stopped. In a letter written from Clarksville, Missouri, on April 1, 1827, a slave named Dorinda contacted her attorney, Hamilton Gamble, who we've also already heard about today, to report that she was being held outside the jurisdiction of the court so that she could not prosecute her suit. And I believe, from looking at the handwriting on this letter, which is at the Missouri History Museum, that Dorinda wrote this letter herself. Sir, I wish to inform that Mr. Phelps is trying his best to keep me a slave. He has got me out of the county where I cannot do nothing for myself, and he says that he will keep me out of your reach if possible. Phelps did keep his slave because Dorinda could not appear in court and forfeited her case under the law. Gamble noted on the outside of the letter that it had been received, quote, after the suit was dismissed. Like Dorinda, at least 14 of the slaves who sued for their freedom were forced to default because they were kidnapped from the jurisdiction of the court. If an enslaved person was lucky and able to safely avoid all of these dangers, there still was the rather frightening process of a courtroom and jury trial to face. Unfortunately, court documents do not tell us the state of mind of those who went through this process. But we have one key to the personal thoughts of an individual in the memoir of Lucy Delaney, who recalled her experience in St. Louis's courthouse. This is her quote. After the evidence from both sides was all in, Mr. Mitchell's lawyer, Thomas Hutchinson, commenced to plead. For 1 hour, he talked so bitterly against me and against my being in possession of my liberty that I was trembling, for I certainly thought everybody must believe him. Indeed, I almost believed the dreadful things he said myself. But Lucy started to feel better as her own attorney, Edward Bates, summed up her side of the case. She had to wait until the following morning for the verdict, however, and, quote, all night long I suffered the agonies of fright. The suspense was something awful. At last the courthouse was reached, and I'd taken my seat in such a condition of helpless terror that I could not tell one person from another. Friends and foes were as one, and vainly did I try to distinguish them. My long confinement, burdened with harrowing anxiety, the sleepless night I'd just spent, the unaccountable absence of my mother, had brought me to an indescribable condition. But when the verdict was announced, Lucy had won her suit for freedom. It's interesting that she mentions Edward Bates being her attorney, and of course later he was Attorney General of the United States under President Lincoln. Dred and Harriet Scott were two of the last people to petition for their freedom in St. Louis, primarily because of the talk we had earlier and the decision of the state Supreme Court, which vacated the whole idea that someone could sue on the basis that they'd once lived in free territory. When they entered the old courthouse in April of 1846, the law, the political climate, and the public perception of slaves and free persons of color were very different than they had been earlier in Missouri's history. If Dred Scott obtained his freedom, it would not free his daughters, Lizzie and Eliza. Only Harriet Scott's freedom could also free the daughters and break the cycle of being hired out to an uncertain fate at the hands of white male masters. Harriet Scott had an even greater motive than her husband to sue for her freedom, as did the large proportion of other black St. Louis women who purchased a new life or helped runaways or sued to escape from bondage in 19th century St. Louis. Court documents are bringing these people to life once again. dimensions of the personalities, the courage, the sacrifice, the many tragedies of the few outstanding triumphs, and the few outstanding triumphs over adversity marked by St. Louis's people of color have been preserved in an unlikely place in the archives of the circuit court. People, most of whom could not read and write, are having their names preserved and being marked down as historical figures, all because they loved liberty. Thank you very much. I suppose we have a couple of minutes left. If you had questions for any of us, for Lynn or the judge or myself, feel free to ask those. Go ahead.
Just in terms of the four we put in, was that from court cases, or what form were the records that you went through at the circuit court?
You're asking what form are the records in? There's a lot of different types of records. There's the record books themselves, which the court clerks kept as a record of each of the cases that came before a judge. So even if it was a case that came up and was just continued, there's a note in there. So you get a sense. It's almost like a diary of every day before the court. Then there's the individual file, the cases themselves. So there's a case file on each case that was brought before the court, and those are legal size documents that are folded up into quarters, kind of in a packet that's about this big, that were kept in till drawers all through these years, and so those are available. There's also there's several different courts that these records pertain to. So there's not only the circuit court, but there was something called an orphan's court, and there was I'm trying to think of all the different names. There were about five or six different types of courts. And, of course, all the probate records are still in existence as well, which is a completely separate court. So, go ahead.
Of course, both sides at the time, abolitionists and slave owners, widely said that. It was in the press, and it was, both hurled accusations that for different reasons. Each of them were trying to cook up the case and all that. But Fehrenbacher has long pages on it, and he's right. And most of the historians say it's not true. It's not true. Most of these attorneys you've heard, Edward Bates, who was later Lincoln's attorney general, and Gamble, who was late. By the way, he was governor of Missouri during the Civil War when the Union troops took over and the Confederate government left the state. He became governor. They were brother-in-laws, too, by the way, married sisters. But those kind of people, they were honorable lawyers. They were honorable lawyers. Now, Dred Scott had a lot of different lawyers. Dred and Harriet had a lot of different lawyers. But the idea that it was all cooked up and it was a friendly suit and it was done by one side, too, that really doesn't stand the test of history. Now, I should let the historian answer, too.
You're absolutely right. Can't do better than that.
Okay.
Who paid for it?
Who paid the lawyers?
Yes.
Well, many of the lawyers were not paid. Right. For sure they were not paid. And in fact, arguing in the United States Supreme Court, two or three of the most famous Missourians were arguing on all sides of the case. I don't mean the same lawyers were arguing. I didn't say that very well. But the lawyers on the different sides of the case, and Harriet's and Dred's lawyers were not paid. Generally, I think that's very clear.
Yeah, it's pretty common that the lawyers didn't receive money. Now, some took the cases with the idea that if they won the case, they would be able to be paid, because most of the time the court was able to hire the slaves who sued for their freedom out. And all the money that was accrued by those slaves was taken. It was locked up in the sheriff's safe. And then whoever won the case would get that money. So if the enslaver won, they would get the money. It's interesting in the Dred Scott case, you go one page beyond when they get the results from the United States Supreme Court, and you see the lawyers for Mrs. Emerson Chafee come into the court and they ask for the money. So all the money that Dred and Harriet Scott made for 11 years while they were being hired out by the court and was in the sheriff's safe was given to Mrs. Emerson Chafee after the end of the suit. So,
another question? Go ahead.
Is that the reason that Dred and Harriet Scott had to go through so many lawyers with all financing, or do you know anything more about the backstory
Well, part of it was the financing of the lawyers, but part of it was them losing at the appellate courts. And candidly, the United States Supreme Court then was organized where there was basically a justice from each circuit. Missouri then was in the Eighth Circuit, and it was Kentucky, Tennessee, and Missouri. But it was set up where there was basically a justice of the Supreme Court from each of the circuits. And the way it was organized, the Southerners got about five of them. Now, there's some qualification there, but for our purposes, that's rather accurate. And so I think that is another reason was the lawyers at different times thought it was not worth pursuing. So both factors, economic and prediction of that. And Judge Smith has joined us in the back. A circuit judge from Arkansas has joined us. I recognized the chief earlier, so I don't seem to be embarrassing you, Judge Smith. But I should add that. Any other judges have joined us? By the way, the district judges left earlier when the PhD began to speak and not the judge. Imagine that. I couldn't resist that. Too much fun. But that's true. They have to. Thank you, Chief. Thank you for bailing me out on that. But they have to do work. Now, there were more hands back here somewhere.
I have a question about those records. Are they
Why don't you filed? Stand up? We'll hear you, if you don't mind.
The records that you were talking
Go ahead.
About, have they or will they or are they digitized for public access?
Not all of the records I've been describing have been digitized, but all of the freedom suits are. And they're currently online on the Washington University website. Eventually, I think that they would like to digitize everything. I think that some specific files have been digitized. I know the ones having to do with Lewis and Clark, the early fur trade, some of the early shipping court cases have been digitized. So they're gradually working at it, and they've got them kind of in different categories. But one other point you might find interesting about the previous topic with the why lawyers were kind of coming and going, one of the first lawyers for Dred and Harriet Scott caught gold fever, as they called it, and he went to California. So he skipped town before they ever got to trial in their first case. So.
Sure. Tom, you deserve a question.
Why did the defendants change? Did Emerson sell the Scotts to Sanford?
Yeah, I wasn't going to go into that in great detail. And by the way, some of it's historical. There's no question that Dr. Emerson, the Army officer, went with Dred and Harriet, let's say Fort Snelling, to make my answer clear and quick. He died shortly thereafter. His widow got them in kind of a life estate, to talk in legal terms here. She had the right to control them during that. Now, it's just everything from there is disputed. Sanford, for our purposes, let's say he's the trustee of the life estate. And so that is how Sanford is named. Ms. Emerson during that time is alive, and she remarries an abolitionist congressman. Yeah, I know. Oh, I know. It has some interest. Lynn, come forward. Come forward if you want to.
Well, I just want to make it clear, because I know the audience doesn't hear this, but Sanford was her brother.
Right.
I think they heard that. So
thank you.
Just go over to him, like, who is he? And she went off to marry the congressman, like you said, and so her brother was left in charge of the state. That's how they were married.
He also went mentally insane halfway through the case. I mean, it's bizarre. It's truly bizarre. Do you want to add something on that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think we have to wrap up soon, but I still see Bill Pieper sitting here, and we haven't mentioned the name of Roswell Field yet.
Yeah.
And he certainly should be mentioned here. Roswell Field was the lawyer who brought the case to the federal level mm-hmm. in 1854 and raised the money through a public subscription drive that was needed by the Scotts defense team. And with all along the idea that it was going to go to the United States Supreme Court, and it was really Field's strategy, which was used before the court in the arguments in 1856. So we definitely have to talk about him. And, of course, we have another wonderful historic site here in town that is devoted to Roswell Field, his life and career. The whole thing about the Mrs. Emerson marrying the abolitionist congressman. And by the way, he wasn't in Congress when they first got married, but he was elected to Congress. And when he was, he, it is believed, did not know
That's true.
That she had once had owned these slaves, had ownership of these slaves. And she transferred ownership to her brother. But once the brother died, which was right on the tail end of the case in 1857, suddenly this threatened to come out that ownership had reverted to her, and that Calvin Clifford Chafee, the Massachusetts abolitionist congressman, suddenly owns the most famous slaves in America. He writes desperate letters to Roswell Field and Montgomery Blair saying, help me, bail me out, do whatever you can, get me out of this terrible situation. And Roswell Field lines out a strategy for how he can unload these slaves without being caught. Of course, he was caught and never reelected to Congress afterwards. But I think there was a kind of a push-pull thing going on there. We always think, oh, how wonderful, you know, they actually got their freedom afterwards. I wonder whether they would have gotten their freedom if they hadn't been pushed into it by the fact of this public embarrassment, political embarrassment for this national figure.
And Dred only lived a year and a half, Lynn? About a year and a half after getting freedom. That's the rest of the story. Harriet, how long do you calculate in years? 18 more years of freedom after that. Okay, we are at our time, and I see Ms. Marshall's up, so let me let her come forward.
I do want to thank everyone for coming, but I do have some special thanks here for our guest speakers, so from the United States Courts. And as you may know, this lecture event is part of the fact that the United States Courts is hosting a temporary exhibit here in the building called Free at Last, and it is on the third floor of the building. So it's optional for you, but if you have the time, I'd like to invite you to come see it now on your way out of the building. It is in a separate elevator system because this elevator will take you down to the first floor, and then you would ride the center elevators back up to the third floor. It's definitely worth the visit. So thanks again for coming.